Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Normal is the enemy. We've heard people say it. You've said it. We're all hoping for things to go back to normal. Of course, this is absurd, not just because normal doesn't exist, but if it did, then isn't normal to blame for what happened? It was our normal life that set up the conditions for the pandemic, that made us so vulnerable and unprepared for something like it to happen. Musonius Rufus, whose story I tell in Lives of the Stoics, knew a thing or two about pining for normal. After all, he was unjustly exiled 4 times, including once to a desolate island off the coast of Greece. While he languished there, missing his old life, hating his provincial existence, he stopped to remind himself and his fellow exiles that when we were home, we did not enjoy the whole earth, nor did we have contact with all men. Normal was a mirage, he was saying, because when he could do things he missed, most of the time he chose not to, just as 90% of New York City never actually took the time to enjoy the city's amenities while they were open, even before the pandemic. Just as your normal life was mostly filled with obligation, with busyness, killing time, complaining. Besides, Musonius pointed something else out too. Did he not still have access to sun, water, and air? Could he not still do good? Could he not still study philosophy? Could he not still find a way to be happy even in exile? Of course he could. And in fact, stripped of distraction and unlimited options, he might even be able to do this better than before. And so it goes for us. Normal does not exist. If it does, it should be something that coming out of this pandemic, we actively try to avoid. Instead, we should try to be creating a new normal, a new world. One built around what we have learned over the last year. And as you go back out into the world, vaccinated, chastened, wiser for what you've experienced, you must create a better life. You should be preserving the things you learned, that you tried over the last year. You should be making changes based on what you experienced. You should be stronger and more prepared for things to change again, because they will. Normal does not exist, and believing that it does is the enemy. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I, like a lot of people, first heard about the Lindy Effect in Nassim Taleb's work, and I remember looking it up and reading the Wikipedia page, and then I remember being in New York City and seeing Lindy's restaurant and being like, oh man, this is so cool. And I've always loved stuff that's been around a long time. My favorite restaurant in Los Angeles is a toss-up between the original Pantry Cafe
and Clifton's Cafeteria, both downtown. I love the Los Angeles Athletic Club, which is second oldest athletic club in the country. I love old stuff. If you read my book, Perennial Seller, you know, this is essentially the premise. Like, what makes something classic? What makes it endure? What makes it stand the test of time? And that's what I try to do with my books. We're actually coming up this year on my anniversary of the 10 year anniversary of my first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, which I thought had to be this thing that you get out to the market right now or it won't be relevant. And, you know, here it is, still selling and selling. The obstacle is away, still selling and selling now, 6-7 years since it's come out. I'm interested in things that endure. Robert Greene's book, 48 Laws of Power, I think will still be read 100 years from now. I love stuff that stands the test of time. That's what draws me to Stoicism, of course, that, you know, you can read the thoughts of Marcus Aurelius and 2,000 years later, they're still, feels like he wrote them yesterday. It feels like you could have written them. It feels like you are Marcus Aurelius, because he, by tapping into something so specific and personal, he actually, and of the moment, he actually managed to create something timeless. So I was fascinated to read a New York Times profile a couple months ago called The Lindy Way of Living by Ezra Marcus. Actually, I myself was the subject of a New York Times profile, maybe 2016, which seems like an eternity ago. Alexandra Alter wrote about it right as Ego and Daily Stoic were coming out. Some of the stuff in the profile has aged well. Some of it hasn't. I remember joking, probably a huge mistake, but she was like, why Stoicism? Aren't you just doing this to get rich? And I said, look, I'm a good marketer. If I was doing something to get rich, don't you think I'd be selling cryptocurrencies or something? Like I said, you know, if you're a good marketer, you could sell anything. Why would I pick an obscure school of ancient philosophy? And of course, she pounced on that. And, you know, the quote in the piece is something like, if you're a good marketer, you can sell anything. And that's why Ryan chose Stoicism, which, again, is the exact opposite of what I'm trying to say. Trend pieces try to do this. They're not so much highlighting the trend usually as they are making fun of it. But hey, here I am 5 years later, still standing. So I guess that goes a little bit to what I'm talking about today. The piece I saw, The Lindy Way of Living, is about a technology lawyer named Paul Scalise, who's tried to design his life, and this is what he talks about in his Substack newsletter and on his Twitter account, about the Lindy effect. Like how we gain wisdom from ancient things, or at least things that have stood the test of time. He's a technology lawyer, and you know, he ironically uses technology to popularize some of these ideas. He has a Substack, which you can check out. It's called The Lindy Newsletter. He has a podcast, Lindy Talk. You can follow him on Twitter at Paul Scalise, and you can also follow his other account at Lindy Effect and at Lindy Diet. His Substack, which you can subscribe to, is Paul Scalise, Paul, S-K-A-L-L-A-S .substack.com. Believe me, I'm a big supporter and believer in newsletters, so I love seeing people that are doing newsletters well. Anyways, here is my interview with Paul Scalise about the Lindy Effect, standing the test of time, what to do, what not to do, according to the Lindy Effect, what the Lindy life looks like. I think it's a good interview. I had a lot of fun talking with him, and I'm looking forward to the book that will inevitably come out of this New York Times piece. And if you want to read more about the Lindy Effect as well, check out Nassim Taleb's books, Anti-Fragile, The Black Swan, The Bed of Procrustes, which I'm pretty sure would carry a couple of those at the Painted Porch bookstore. Pretty Lindy business, if I must say so myself. I'm talking to you from our 140-year-old brick building on Main Street in Bastrop, Texas, which has been a store of some kind for many, many decades, survived pandemics and wars and crises and depressions and pandemics. I got to get back to work, so I will cut off this intro right here. Here's my interview with Paul Scalise about the Lindy Effect. I'm very familiar with the Lindy Effect. I find it fascinating. But to people who are not familiar, just as I'm asked to define Stoicism all the time, give me a working definition of the Lindy Effect.
Sure. It's a probabilistic, heuristic, basically, which is the duration of something that's been around. You can calculate it's going to be around for that duration longer, right? So if something's been around maybe 30 years, maybe you can expect it to be around another 30 years. And this works for, obviously, things that are not alive, like a human body. It works for ideas or art or styles or technology, scientific theories. That's sort of the basic definition of the Lindy effect.
And you're sort of what you write about and talk about, sort of how you apply the Lindy effect is, although obviously we also have to be careful of the naturalistic fallacy, but your argument is kind of like, if it's been around for a while, you can trust it more than some brand new thing, which may be based on bad science or bad information, or maybe a fad, or may just not have any staying power.
Right. Yeah. So I play around with it. I use it a lot for, it's basically a hedge against modernity. And, you know, we're constantly getting bombarded by novelty all the time, which is, you know, great because, you know, it's always nice to have options and choice. And, you know, I'd rather have too much novelty than maybe too little, right? It's like you'd rather have too many lawyers in a system than not enough when you need help in a way. But I think there are domains where it is pretty valuable, as far as like architecture, diet, health, psychology is another good one, ways to live, sort of systems that have been around for a long time. I don't really utilize it in medicine at all, but maybe preventative sure. measures, it's actually a good tool. And also in art and music, in books. So there's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of domains I sort of utilize it in. And it's a fun frame that I think people can, you know, I think I gained a little bit of a following because I think it allows people to actually look around their life and their environment too, and the environment that, you know, radically changed, right, in the 20th century and then changed again, I would say, in the mid-2000s with the advent of social media and the destruction of the media monoculture, right? Like, you know, I don't know if, you know, you would have had this podcast in 1997, right?
Right.
That would have been, right. So I think there's been two waves of large changes we've sort of gone through. And this can serve, this heuristic can serve as a way to kind of just give you a hedge before you undertake, you drink something, you follow a fad diet, you follow some new age advice, you follow some psychology paper that doesn't get replicated. So I think it's a useful tool.
And the hedge is basically against the predilection, which is increasingly common in modern society, the arrogance of like, we have invented something totally new that changes everything. And the reality is most either it doesn't actually change anything or it changes something that that was there for a reason. And there's going to be consequences for this change.
Yeah, yeah. The change, especially when it's rapid, you know, it can have kind of effects that, you know, we don't foresee. Like people always say, oh, the car replaced the horse, and it's true. But, you know, 50,000 people die in a car accidents every year. We accept that. We built a society around car culture, right? Where a lot of places in America, you can't even go for a walk, or you can't even
right. And then you go to Europe. Environment. You go to Europe, it's not designed around the car, and you're like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah, Europe exists as like an open-air museum now for people to go and just walk around because it's like nice to like be around. It's like, so you could have that here, you know, but we went through this tremendous, I would say very fast change into a car-centric world very quickly in the 20th century. I don't know if we're going back to more of a, you know, European design, although you do see you're seeing some sort of sustainable urbanism online now. You're seeing people sort of, you know, want to sort of walk around. So that's one example. Other examples are various diets that sort of like veganism or paleo. Those are some big ones that don't seem to have a historical anesthetic. And then you see certain dangers. You see certain kidney problems with only eating protein every day. You see people having to supplement with, you know, B12 if you're a vegan. And then you see reports that, you know, excessive B12 intake is linked to a lung cancer. So whenever you're messing with a system, especially with rapid change, there's going to be effects. And maybe the effects aren't visible right now. Maybe the effects aren't visible tomorrow, but there's going to be changes.
Well, what I love about the Lindy effect, you've talked about how you sort of first discovered it through Nassim Taleb, but what I love is that the Lindy effect is not only really old, but it's named after a restaurant that still exists that's like 90 years old.
No, the restaurant shut down, I think.
It closed during the pandemic. Years ago, it was still open. So this
might closed during the pandemic.
let's see if Lindy's is still open.
I've never been there.
That would be terrible news.
Well, it happens. Restaurant's a hard business, right?
It says Lindy's was two different deli and restaurant chains in Manhattan. The first was operated from 1921 to 1969. 1979, it trademarked it, opened new restaurants, the last of which closed in February 2018. Well, this is just devastating news.
There you go.
What are we doing? We should just cancel the episode. The Lindy effect has been disproven. Right. Although maybe the point is that what is exactly the middle period between it opened and it closed? That's when it peaked, and it's been a dead man walking for you know 30, 40 years.
Yeah, I like you did a book on Stoicism, right? So
yes.
and that literature is thousands of years old. And, you know, the ancients didn't have access to maybe like our knowledge of physics, but they had access to our knowledge of human nature. Or you know, that's what they studied. That's what they thought about. They wrote about. And, you know, then, you know, these writings, which work, by the way, this sort of having more upside than downside, negative visualization, these great Stoic techniques work today because we're still the same human, right? Human nature doesn't really change. And you know, we should expect that literature to keep lasting for another couple thousand years. And so there's like a deeper Lindy effect of than really, you know, is this business that opened in like 1970 gonna last?
Sure.
Maybe, but there's like another aspect of literature and human nature. And then you look at psychology papers, there's like weird stuff going on there. I don't know if you realize, like I said, there's like, it doesn't replicate. Or the people they test on don't represent, you know, society. There's something called p-hacking, which I won't get into, but there's some solid, you know, Lindy lessons we can take, I'm sure, as you know.
Well, no, that's been the interesting thing. You know, every once in a while, someone will comment on sort of like how well my books have done, or, you know, like that I like sort of brought, you know, like, oh, your books are so great. I see them everywhere, or whatever. And I always try to remind them that I have a really unfair advantage, which is that I didn't invent anything from scratch. If I'd sat down and I was writing The Obstacles Away, or Ego is the Enemy, or Stillness is the Key, and I was coming up with a philosophy from scratch, this would require genius to some level, right? A creative genius to create something new, which is like the hardest thing to do. I was simply reimagining and re-explaining and popularizing a thing that has resonated with people for not even 2,000 years, but going back to like the year 400 BC. So going on 2,500 years, this has been tested over and over and over again and endured. The chances of it disappearing tomorrow are relatively slim. This is also the same. Why does Star Wars work? It's because Star Wars is based on the hero's journey, which is sort of Lindy-fied to the ultimate degree. This is the myth that one of the founding myths of all of, you know, sort of Western civilization. I think the idea is you want to tap into something that goes way, way back. It's just safer and more likely to resonate with people.
Yeah, it's also, you know, think of how many transfers of people that these books had to go through generation after generation who also found it valuable. And crucially, they survived, right? The people who did read these works and implement them. So it's been, you know, right, time-tested and useful. It's also, I'm skeptical of everything in the 20th century, though. So you mentioned okay. Star Wars, because I do find that the 20th century was a closed system. Like, there was only a few movies you could watch. There was only a few television stations. You had to buy a CD, cost $20. Everything was sort of top down, and you know, even decades, right? Even decades had their own style, their own trends, and it seems like we're entering like a system now where the mainstream is either stuck or the mainstream just seems different than when I remember it in the 90s. Whereas you have this huge now ecosystem on the internet, this bottom up, you know, millions of songs on SoundCloud, lots of influencers, and it just seems more real than what's happening above the board.
So. I guess, but the Lindy effect sort of hypothetically doesn't discriminate between something that lasts for 5 years and something that lasts for 50 years and something that lasts for 5,000 years, right? Like the Lindy effect is simply saying like, basically what's in motion tends to stay in motion for as long as it's been in motion, or, you know, whatever, however you would actually translate that. So I guess the question is, like you look at something like Star Wars, is Star Wars going to be relevant 200 years from now? Maybe, maybe not. But like, if you're George Lucas, you had a longer run than I think Star Wars beat Smokey and the Bandit or something, you know, opening weekend. Like, it certainly had a longer run than just about anything that came out when it came out, because it did tap into something a tad more sustainable than, like, Star Wars is not still watched today because of its cutting edge special effects. People right. are taking their grandkids to go see the original Star, or want to show their grandkids the original Star Wars, because something has transcended the era that it came out that still resonates, you know, 50 years later.
Yeah. But I'll give, here's another example, rock and roll, right? The number one popular genre of me growing up was, mm-hmm. was rock music. And it's basically dead right now. If you look at sales from sort of that classic rock era, they're finally kind of going down a little bit. You're getting less and less newer generations of people kind of listening to, you know, growing up with Led Zeppelin, I guess, which was always sort of
right.
kind of tradition growing up as a young man in America, right? And then so I wonder if that's sort of going to keep going, or is that going to peter out over time? Because, like I said, in the 20th century, I don't think we had a lot of options. Like, there was a there was a monoculture that you engaged with, and if there's no other place to go, so
that's yeah, that makes sense. Have you read the Klosterman book, But What If We're Wrong?
Yeah, I read it.
Great. Yeah, he's like, you know, who was the biggest musician in the world in like 1910? It was like John Philip Sousa or something.
Right.
Yeah, and now sort of all that's left of that entire period is a tiny echo. Although that's one of my favorite parts in Meditations. Marcus Aurelius sort of over and over again, he's like, who's ever heard of Vespasian? Or, you know, who's still around? Who still remembers the famous names from you know, Hadrian's court or whatever? And I remember I did a Daily Stoic email about this not that long ago, because I, like you, I was fascinated by Spotify, and I was listening to like best of the 90s rock or something. And I was alive during the 90s when that rock was popular. So
right.
I knew most of the songs, but every once in a while, like a song would come on that I'd never heard before. And I'd look it up and be like, oh, this was a number one hit in, you know, 1996. And I just like never heard it before, which is pretty unusual. But then if I went to the 80s and I listened to the same playlist, you know, it'd be, let's say, 20, 30% more, like big hits that I'd never heard of. And then 70s, 60s, as you start to go back, this is exactly what Marcus Aurelius talks about, is that very quickly, the names and references and bands of enormously popular things start to become much more mysterious and unknown. And so, like, there is this thing about the Lindy effect that's seductive, where you're like, I want to make something that lasts forever. But I mean, like, John Philip Sousa doesn't give a shit that he's dead. You know, like that his music's not... Sorry, John Philip Sousa doesn't give a shit that people aren't yeah. listening to his music anymore. He's dead.
Yeah, it's. I think everybody, when you sort of write a book... I mean, you wrote some books, right? So I think you have that in the back of your mind, right? Like, of, hey, I want this to be read... in a few decades, at least, or at least I don't want it to just be some internet, you know, clickbait thing. Like, I think almost and a million books get published every year now, and it's just this overflow in information. And who knows what's going to last, because now there's just everything, right? But I think that was a common sentiment. Like, and who knows what comes out of the 20th century? Right now, I think maybe the Beatles might be really the only band they people maybe consider what rock and roll is. I believe in the book, Klosterman said, like, if they were teaching a class about rock and roll in the year 3000. You know, they'd probably pick somebody like Chuck Berry and be like, this is the...
That struck me as so wrong. Like, it's not even
the
worst guess. Like, there's no way he's... that struck me as very strange. I could see Elvis, but I've read something else recently that was like, you know, in 1,000 years, like, the Beatles songs will be lullabies and no one will remember that somebody wrote them, which I thought was an interesting take too.
Yeah, I agree. The Chuck Berry thing was a weird take, because even in the 90s, he wasn't really, you know, well known. Like, other musicians would maybe talk about him and saying, oh, they liked him, but it wasn't like he was sort of this like into rock culture in a way that maybe the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or some of these big, like, Rolling Stones or even Bob Dylan were sort of. Like, there was this story, right? We're all part of the story. And then each generation from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and that's all gone, right? So that tradition's all gone. And we're moving into sort of a new way of listening to music or finding music, which is difficult. We're actually, I think, getting more into like a localist circles now, and like creating your own media environment can be very important.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like, for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Yeah, well, what you see, I think, when you really study it is like how random it is, right? So like a lot of the books that we consider to be classics of the 20th century, like The Great Gatsby, I think is a brilliant novel. I think eventually it might have been rediscovered on its own. But like one of the reasons The Great Gatsby is popular is that the U.S. government bought millions of copies of it and distributed it to the troops during World War II. And a bunch of the classic sort of novels that became popular from the early part of the 20th century were because
that was just like one of the titles in the list of paperbacks that the government decided was like okay to give away to the troops for entertainment to read as they were like waiting to invade Normandy. So it's like, I could, I guess, see an argument where Chuck Berry, through some set of freak instances, is elevated above someone who's actually much more popular now, or that you might guess. But I think, to me, the meta lesson is that, like, history doesn't care about you and doesn't care about what you've done or how popular you are or what people thought of you. The sands of time sort of toss things around, and it all comes out as it comes out, and there's not that much that you can really do to influence it one way or another. Like, to me, that's the message of Ozymandias, the poem. It's like, he was the biggest king in the world, and now it's like there's two legs left and nobody knows all the things that he did.
Right. And any attempt really by a top-down entity, right? Because I think when we're talking about the Lindy effect, we're also talking about it being transmitted organically and bottom up by like regular people, or hey, this is good. And the 20th century was weird, right? You had CIA funding for certain modern art movements because they wanted to counteract the Soviets or something. There's just a lot of weird stuff going on there. But and there's also an architecture movements, which are unprecedented, right? This era of complete smoothness, these sort of square kind of places without details, without ornation, which, you never really saw this. Everything sort of had a fractal quality to it, and ancestral building traditions. And all of a sudden it's like, no, we're going to try these new architectural styles. And a lot of them don't, they leave you kind of alienated. And the problem with architecture is you can't just tear them down and, fix them. They're sort of these monuments to the time, right? If you go to Washington, D.C., you see this, like, all these brutalist buildings, which kind of look really off in a way. But there's an aliveness to things that are sort of Lindy certified, right? Like Seneca or Cicero, whenever they talk about loss aversion or negative advice or the paradox of progress in Lucretius, or even Aesop's fables have stuff that's still pretty relevant. So.
Well, I was writing about this something for Daily Stoic recently, where there's a reference in Marcus Aurelius to the country mouse and the town mouse, which is in Aesop's fable. They both go visit each other and they find the other ones. The city is very stressful, the country is very boring. But what struck me about it is like how old Aesop's fables would have been to Marcus Aurelius. You have the most powerful man in the world referencing this fable, assuming everyone will get the reference, or not really, because he's, I guess, not writing for publication, but that, today it's translated and you either get the reference or you don't. But just the idea that, like, we don't really know when Aesop was alive, but these fables were already like certified by hundreds of years of experience, by the time they're being referenced. Realizing, what's that idea that like Cleopatra lives closer to our time than like the building of the pyramids? That some of this stuff was so old back then. That always like catches me by surprise.
It's even, a lot of those guys were actually copying older stuff. Like, I think there's this person called Ahikar of Nineveh, who Aesop took some stories from. He's even older than Aesop. And then that gets transmitted to Fabrius, who's a Roman, kind of does these stories like Aesop. And then La Fontaine, La Bruyere, we go through the French traditions, the so-called moral sciences. That's sort of what philosophy kind of was, in a way, a lot about practical advice, useful advice, not so much abstract concepts all the time. And then you see sort of it flow even today, right? So, it's funny, like you kind of, there was a Stoic wave you were a part of. I don't think you were the only one. It was sort of this wave where Stoicism, became a thing in America. And like recently we had fasting come in. And it reminded me how like America cuts off tradition, right? It like, when you're an American, you're sort of forward thinking. You're all about, problem solving, but history is not really a part of it. And tradition doesn't really come along. But then it we reintroduce tradition, like piece by piece, a little bit back into America, right? And so you'll see these waves or even good food, like food is so good now. Remember, like, you know, food in America wasn't that good. You go to the grocery store, like there'd be cans, and people would, you know, foreigners would kind of say, oh, American food sucks. And then you had the Whole Foods revolution, right? And there's this emphasis on, you know, kind of just eating better stuff. And now that's even going further. We're talking about, you know, the meat, like how's the meat that we're eating? It should be grass fed, right? So in a, you know, that's just tradition though. So we're just sort of reintroducing tradition piece by piece in America and finding out what works.
Yeah, there's a line, I forget where I heard it. They probably stole it from someone else too. It's that traditions are an answer to a problem we don't remember.
Right.
And that most of these traditions were developed for a reason, could have been a bad reason, but it was developed in response to something that used to be commonplace or used to trouble people. And they were like, this will address that. And that's why we do it that way. It's not like, there's not no reason that we do it the way that we do. There's a reason. It might not be a good reason, but there you go.
Yeah. And especially, you know, in certain domains, right? Like I said, like, I don't, you know, bloodletting, I'm not talking about bloodletting for all your problems, right? Even though giving blood does have a lot of benefit, and I do it sometimes. But there's certain domains where, you know, we've made incredible kind of leaps and bounds, but there's other ones where I think, you know, like everybody's going to a therapist, and I think that's great. But they didn't really have therapists back then. So what did we have? Maybe we had friends. Oh, but people have less friends now. Okay. There was like priests and stuff, but we're living in a post-religious age now. So sometimes there's a substitution that goes in place as well as society tries to sort of, address certain issues. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. That you know, there's. I was talking about this with Kate Fagan, the journalist, and we were talking about how there's sort of always a certain amount of like toxic energy, you know, that manifests itself in the form of, say, like bigotry or repression or persecution. Probably the oldest recipient of this is the Jews, right? But there's this like toxic energy that just gets channeled in different directions, right? It's part of the human sort of, not maybe not the individual human makeup, but it's what happens when groups of humans get together, is that we pick others and sort of persecute them, or, you know, make them bear the brunt of, you know, we sort of scapegoat them, so on and so forth. But that oftentimes, I like the idea of substitutions, that we just substitute different things as an outlet for certain passions or needs. As you're saying, that maybe priest becomes a therapist, or the lack of friends creates the need for someone to confide in someone, and thus therapists or therapy sort of enters to fill that breach.
Yeah. And I also think it gets weirder though, because, you know, people are taking Adderall to go to work, right? It's not just coffee anymore, which is pretty Lindy compliant, or tea, which is really deep Lindy. We know that's not going to really mess with you. But now we're getting started on sort of some hardcore chemistry changes to our bodies to adapt to sort of work, to out-compete other people in sort of these jobs that we're in, which is just a huge part
of question. Sorry, you're saying instead of just questioning, like, why do I need to take the drug to, instead of not going to work, we take the drug that makes us go to work.
Yeah. And also to go to work, you know, some people need it to function, but like, you know, that when you enter into some of these organizations, people are taking it to get ahead. And also to work way, you know, way more efficient. There's a real competition, especially in America, to, you know, to win, especially, if, you know, in these jobs that are highly competitive. And, you know, these aren't tested. Right, these aren't sort of long term amphetamines. Like, it reminds me of the smoking, right, which was huge in the 20th century, but only started in like 1905, really, as far as the cigarette, right?
Yeah,
the cigarette, this really elegant product, this with this package, and you know, it's, you take a little bit every day, you know, and it just, it's addictive, and you just keep, and it's really cool. It's still really cool in my opinion, but you know, even I don't smoke, but it's, it kind of wrecked a lot of people in society. And then we had this thing where people kind of stopped doing it, and there was these health concerns, and then the government started banning it in the, you know, indoor smoking. I remember that. It was the early 2000s. It was like this wave all across the world in a way. And you know, smoking rates are a lot lower than they were in the 70s, right, or the 60s, where they started peaking. And so, you know, in a way, the cigarette came, you know, people in that century tested it. They were tested on the cigarette. Many, you know, didn't do well, right? Many didn't survive. And now you're seeing a lot of people kind of stay away from that. And I think we're seeing that again with the stuff like amphetamines, but also testosterone replacement therapies going mainstream, like all types of kind of transhumanist procedures. We can even go to the environment, which is we're genetically modifying mosquitoes. Who knows what's going to happen? So
what do you think of psychedelics, right? Because psychedelics on the one hand are very old, and on the other hand, this idea of like using them a lot and using them to solve your psychological issues or as a form of therapy seems relatively new, or at least relatively without precedent. I'm always very Silicon Valley seems to not have a lot of self-awareness as far as pushing us to do things culturally, technologically, that strike me as very different than how things have always been done, without ever questioning what foundations it's shaking or what, you know, part of the brain chemistry it's messing with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I think microdosing is crazy. I mean, I think you're just sort of, that's completely unprecedented, which is taking tiny amounts of psychedelics every day.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to go that route, maybe just doing it, you know, once and then, or twice, or just spacing it out. And I think you had the same issue with cigarettes, which it became a daily thing, and it wrecked people. And I think once you start daily consumption, and your body, you know, I think you're going to see radical changes when you start undergoing chronic damage, or chronic harm, versus, you know, once in a while, which, you know, smoking a cigar every once in a while, or a pipe, is probably better than just, you know, smoking cigarettes. So I do see the value in psychedelics. I think that's interesting. I think there is some of a precedent for it, but I think, you know, microdosing reminds me of cigarette smoking.
Yeah. And I'm very leery anytime someone tells me they have a medical or like a sort of like a single solution to a complicated, pervasive, long-standing issue, right? So you're like, oh, this cures PTSD, or oh, this cures whatever. Or I think this is more common, oh, this psychedelic gave me enlightenment, right? Like this thing that human beings have been seeking out, mostly through a lot of hard work and fasting and study and research and exploration and travel, you know, getting to enlightenment, this thing that took that's always been very hard and few have ever attained, the idea that, you know, ingesting some leaf or mushroom with a shaman right in Brazil is going to get you everything you want with none of the consequences. That strikes me as not just naive, but historically not worked out well in similar scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, it's reductionist, right? So, you know, I'm skeptical of anybody who doesn't address the environment that you're in, right? And if anybody's ever had a bad boss and in life knows that, you know, you cope with other things, and you don't engage with sort of the elephant in the room, right? Which is the environment you're in, or you've lived in sort of, I remember living in an apartment with like low ceilings in a basement. And I was like sad all the time. Yeah. You live in a shitty place, right?
Yeah.
So there's no like, yeah, I think Silicon Valley engages in a reductionist view of take this thing, right? Virtual reality, right? That's something they always talk about. And it's like, I've always noticed that when my environment has improved, you know, I improve as well. And that's sort of what to sort of focus on, more of a holistic view of health than do a drug or do this technology. And I think that's sort of more of a Lindy way of looking at health is looking at your environment.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
What do you think of the sort of Amish attitude towards technology or certain changes where it's not that they're necessarily anti it, but that they're intentional and deliberate about what they allow into the community? That's sort of the question of like, does this make the community better? Yes or no, as opposed to this makes things easier. You know what I mean? Is that kind of how you think about the things that you integrate into your life?
I think of it more as like an individual, though, because I'm not part of an Amish community. And I don't think a lot of people are, especially in America, as part of a... I mean, that's sort of, you know, for good or for worse, right? We live in an individualized society. Like, we're not property of our family. We're not... people look at these small villages as these really nice, idyllic places, but they don't see the feuds. They don't see when people in the village hate you, I mean, your life sucks and they could really hurt you and your reputation means a lot versus going into a city where things are, you're a little bit more anonymous, or a town. So I think the Amish live in a way, that's different than I think most Americans live. I think that, you know, their critique of technology is interesting. I think we all need to kind of critique it a little bit. Like I opened up TikTok recently and I was like, wow, this is like TV on steroids. Like, yes. Like you're going to get people addicted to this. Like they're going to, this is like a new level of social media. It makes like Twitter look like reading a book. Right. So I was kind of shocked by and like the algorithm is aggressive and it could really hone in on what sort of preferences you want. So I really felt when I was looking at TikTok, like this is something new and maybe I don't really need this in my life right now. I think generally I have a skepticism of new technology, of how it could influence me and influence my mood. And is this, you know, am I using this technology or is it using me?
I love that question. That to me, that's the question I try to ask. And I think most of the time you realize like, oh, you're the product here. Like it's using you and selling you to advertisers or whatever. And that's why it's free.
Right. Hey, I'm getting a lot of value from sort of, I know who to follow on Twitter. It's not this, you know, terrible politics driven, you know, drama where people are, you know, yelling at Trump or something or for Trump. And I'm, you know, you're getting caught up in some, you know, weird culture war. You can use these platforms a little bit if you're good with knowing how to follow and have it, you know, use it for you as well. And also, you know, use it as a creative expression. But yeah, ultimately that's sort of the, you know, is it using me or am I using it? And I think that's one of the, and how to create your own media environment are sort of these two big pressing questions that people sort of have, because look, you work a job, you know, you have your weekends and then you have, you know, you have to exercise, you have to eat dinner, you have a few hours left, you know, in the day. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, engage with something that's poisonous on my days off of work, you know, so.
But you're on Twitter, right? You don't find it to be poisonous?
No. I like it. Obviously I don't, it's good to take breaks and it's good to not always be on it, but I don't follow people. I try not to follow people who are poisonous or at least do it with humor, and not, you know, be, you know, just messed up. Like you saw this with the Trump years. I mean, you saw it reach a crazy, like, you would look at the New York Times front page and it was wild. You'd go on Twitter, it was wild. And he, you know, Trump would try to shock you. And it was this weird game between, you know, Democrats and Republicans. And I don't use it for that. I think I use it for, you know, talking about some ideas, my concepts, which I think are more interesting.
Yeah, it's that's something I think about too. Obviously, as a writer, I love books. That's the medium that I communicate with. I think that's there's a reason I always tell people, like, books are actually a great piece of technology. A hardcover book or a physical book is a great piece of technology. That's why it's existed more or less in this form for so long. I like to point out, like, when you watch like a sci-fi movie or something, you know, a space movie, like they have all these doors that like automatically, these complicated, you know, technologically advanced doors. And then now that we live in the future, like doors are still made of wood with a handle and a key. because like a door is a regular door accomplishes like 98% of what most people need in most scenarios. And I think books sort of do that as a great piece of technology. But you also, as a creator, kind of have to have this humility of going like, not everyone finds books to be the best piece of technology. And that's also a reason possibly to use the technology, right? Like, so for Daily Stoic, we put out stuff on Instagram, we put out stuff on TikTok, we put out stuff on YouTube. But I try to make sure always that my frame of reference for viewing and thinking about the world remains, or, you know, we're doing this podcast, but my frame of reference remains long form content in the form of writing. And I've just found a lot of journalists, I think, have had their brains broken by Twitter. They think now in 140 and 280 characters. And that's not a Lindy way of approaching the world.
So yeah, so books are amazing. They can change your life. They change my life. And I've never had my life changed by a movie or song. So I find that medium to be special, because it even gets deeper, I've noticed. Like I'll read a book I really like and I'll really like the author, but if I read a book and I don't like it, sometimes I'll not like reading in a way in general, and I have to take some time off, right? Mm-hmm. So it's special when it hits right, man. There's nothing like a book or text to really shake you up, and you walk outside and you have a different lens. And I just never felt that with any other medium.
It's so weird that would be true, given that like there'd be no evolutionary, like the book. Let's say the first sort of oral story, you know, that we have reference of dates back to 5,000 years. That's, I think Gilgamesh is like the first sort of story we see written down or whatever, say 5,000 years. That's too short for evolution. And yet it really is true that sort of books just hit us in a special place. It's pretty magical and inexplicable.
Yeah. I think we're finding out that like civilization's also way older than we think. And I was reading James C. Scott, Against the Grain, last year, and he really talks about how there was like older civilizations than like Ur or Uruk, and you know the reason they came up with literacy at some point was for you know taxing and contracts, and there might and these plagues would come in and destroy the you know the city, and then they would have to start over again. So you know we don't really know how old civilization is, I think. But going back to your point about journalists, yeah, they're chasing clicks. They're chasing eyeballs. They're not trying to – they're like in a trend, like the yeah. trend of the day. They're not trying to build an idea. They're not trying to build something like a sustainable or they're not engaging with interesting ideas. They're just sort of – yeah, I mean, this is trash, right? I mean, usually – I mean – it's kind of interesting because you could use it to exemplify some things, right? Like Anthony Bourdain, you know, committed suicide a few years ago, right? And that was news. And when you read Ovid, you know, he talks about, you know, how bad a breakup is for a guy and how maybe, you know, it doesn't hurt as much for a woman. And there could be an asymmetry in human nature there where, you know, a guy really feels the breakup more than a woman. So, you know.
No, I want to go back to this journalism thing, but I was thinking about your point about civilization being old. I was telling my 4.5-year-old about cave paintings. You know that you know going back tens of thousands of years, we have these cave paintings. We were looking at some of them online, and then we were in Big Bend National Park a couple weeks ago, and we were on this walk, and he found a cave painting. Like we were walking, and there's wow. by the hot spring. There's this hot springs you can go to on the Rio Grande River, and there was a sign. So it's not like it's a famous landmark, but there was a cave painting, and we're looking at this sort of etching done in you know the side of this cliff. It could be 300 years old. It could be 5,000 years old. I don't remember them saying, but just. One of the things I love about my profession, let's not say I'm a writer, let's say I'm an artist. I'm just sort of creating a thing that doesn't need to exist, but people purchase it because it provides value for them in some way, the sort of more expansive definition of art. There's something beautiful and haunting and humbling and also inspiring about this idea that's like, people have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years, just like people have been having this exact conversation we're having for thousands of years, that we're doing it remotely and it's being recorded, of course, is not Lindy, but like, this is what Socrates was doing, you know, just kicking shit around.
Yeah. Even when you read they talk about the good old days too. They ancient people even had their own ancient times, right? Mm-hmm. Which they look fondly back on, like we're talking about right now too. So in a sense we're part of some fractal kind of, situation here that's reoccurring throughout history. And you know what else is cool about history? It's also, we weren't alone, by the way. We're starting to see that there's lots of other human-like species, like Neanderthals, Denisovans, and just way more diversity and type of human-like creatures that also could do, painting. And there was this large diversity in the past that we lived with, these multiple types of people. And we're alone right now for the first time in maybe 30,000 years when the Neanderthals died out. But, you know, when I look at like genetic testing or genetic modification or CRISPR or any of these crazy technologies coming out, and I look at like Instagram and, you know, people really obsessed with modifying themselves, sometimes I wonder if we're going back to like deep history and like people are going to try to differentiate themselves from other humans in a way, but I don't know.
Yeah. There's a, I forget what civilization it is, but there's some like 5,000 or 10,000 year old tablet that's basically like kids these days suck, you know, and they're not as good as kids these days. And you're just like, oh yeah, we've been struggling with a lot of this for a very long time. And I think your point goes back to what we're talking about earlier, which is that there's this sort of energy evolutionarily or what have you of like differentiating yourself or doing this that probably does go to our deep history. It's just now we have more means of doing it, or it's accelerated or amplified by technology that we have.
Yeah. And I think how to live with technology is sort of going to be like the great you know, debate, right? So yeah, here we are, you know, geographically separate, but we have this infrastructure where we can talk. And, you know, are we building like a new kind of localism here where, you know, you sort of identify with people in a tribe that you choose to identify with sort of online more than maybe that you have to live around geographically? Because we are kind of localist biased, I think. Like, we do want a group. So at some point, and like through technology, we're still clustering too in different ways. So I think, you know, and then the rise of remote work too is interesting. Now you can maybe kind of choose where to live. Like, where do you want to live now? Like, a lot of people may have a choice now. And so you might see some, you know, like a bottom up movement of people who are living either rurally or in towns, or maybe they want to stay in a city. But I think technology giving us a choice is going to, before you had to move to a city to work, it's going to be interesting. I think some patterns are going to come out of that.
Yeah. Someone just sent me a New York Times piece, and the title is "Books Are Forever, Bestsellers Are Fleeting," which I think is a good way of describing what we're talking about, which is that the individual things, you know, can change, but sort of overall theme, of things at work are always there.
Yeah. And I think there is some correlation between bestsellers not lasting after 10 years, as far as, say, I think Nassim Taleb told me that, where he was saying something about how bestsellers have a huge drop off, but you know, and there's like, if you look at sales for certain books, you will see it like a continuous sales over the years at a low level, but it's pretty consistent. And that could be an indication that it might sort of become Lindy at some point. You know, I call it like, what's your Lindy bet from the 20th century, right? Mm-hmm. And like, that's a game you can play. Like, what do you think is going to survive, right? And bestsellers kind of have a huge drop off, whereas some medium type sales books, they do well over time. Yeah.
Well, I wrote a book a few years ago called Perennial Seller about the publishing industry, which is, there's this interesting fact, which is that actually, when you look at the New York Times bestseller list, perennial sellers are deliberately excluded, right? So a book that sells 10,000 copies in 1 week will appear on the list, but a book, you know, and forever be a New York Times bestseller. But a book that sells 1,000 copies a week for a year will probably never hit the list. And then a book that sells 1,000 copies a week for 30 years will also never appear on the list, despite selling, you know, eventually hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies. So it's pretty insane how actually the things that are the most perennial are obscured from our view. We don't actually understand how persuasive or pervasive and sustained they are, because we're always hearing the new things. There's no media incentive to go like, old thing that was popular is still roughly the same level of popular it's been for a long time. It's only the new thing. And I think that's funny, both of you and I, this is what I want to talk to you about, both that you and I were subjects of New York Times profiles. The vast majority of New York Times trend pieces are about things that, you know, the trend is actually a fad, it disappears. But we're being profiled as if we're the inventors of something, when in reality we're tapping into a force that's existed for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't invent this, you know, and I don't, you know, this has been around for a long time, and you know, it's just, look, it takes talent to sort of, I think, post or write and get some traction. I think there's a certain sense of, you know, you got to have something to say, integrate it with your life, kind of figure it out. But the things, you know, we talk about maybe aren't, you know, definitely just part of a long stream of history that sort of gets reintroduced, you know, periodically. And like what you're saying about the New York Times bestseller, like, yeah, the Oscars should probably be 10 years delayed
right,
for Best Picture, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the Best Picture of 2011? Like, what's held up in a way? Like, that's what, you know, going into perennial mindset instead of just a novelty mindset is interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And yeah, I've got to imagine if you did Where Are They Now on most, like my piece in the New York Times, I think it was 2016, you know, where were the people who were published, you know, the week before, maybe the week after, where are they now? You could probably make good money just betting against the people in the, it's probably better than even odds that I would disappear shortly after the profile, as opposed to be selling more books and have a bigger sort of audience now than I did then, right? Because often what qualifies someone to be in the news or to be profiled is their novelty, not right. their likelihood of standing the test of time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like if you were to you know, I guess we're entering the age of big data, which you could probably actually do a research report on all the trend pieces in the New York Times and see, you know, and look at outcomes for the last like 30 years. And I would bet to say that it'd be rare to see people still kind of at least on an upswing or at least consistent with what they were doing before. But yeah, we'll get you into the New York Times novelty, even though what we're talking about is something, you know, about consistency in a way, which is, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the last thing I want to talk to you about? You sort of talk about the idea of like a Lindy life, right? Like what are the components of a Lindy life? Maybe we start with a Lindy walk, but if one was trying to design a life based on some of these more tried and tested practices, what do you think that looks like?
Yeah. Well, it depends if you're an employee, right? And you got to be somewhere.
Sure.
For a certain amount of time, right? And that's sort of, you have to think about that, right? And a lot of things you're forced to sort of sit in a chair for, you know, 10 hours or 8 hours. I don't know how the Lindy that is to sort of be in this posture, right? Versus standing up, walking around, or even laying around. And I think people got a taste of some quasi-freedom with the work from home experiment for the last year and a half. And you're seeing some resistance to that because people can take a walk at their lunch break, or they can sort of engage with different postures. So I always try to keep in mind that, you know, people work for a living. And whenever you're talking about, you know, a framework for looking at life, that's sort of important to realize that you don't have a choice with a lot of, you know, your life. But a Lindy life, it would probably be like, you know, food and drink that's old, right? And that's less, you know, at least 500 years old. You don't need to be experimenting with any newness. But if you are, I would say don't make it chronic, right? Like, don't drink a Diet Coke every day. We don't know, right? What's going to happen. Lindy walks. I take a lot of walk. I try to do 20,000 steps a day. I try to engage
Let's talk about the walk. So 20,000 steps, I think a lot of people measure their walks in distance, but what about time? Like how much time are you walking a day?
It's probably like 2 hours.
That's beautiful. I mean, so you're carving out a good chunk of your day to be outside and to be on the move.
I mean, that's how I write. Like, I don't know how you write, but I write when I'm walking. And then I, you know, that's where this, like we talk about psychedelics, I almost feel like it's almost like a minor, it's like a creativity hack that's almost as equal to psychedelics, which is just walking around. And you just have all these ideas that come at you. And then I sit down and I just really connect them and I edit them. But the walking around is where 90% of my writing or insights or thoughts of where my production comes from. Yeah, obviously, you feel good, too, and I like it as well. But it's almost like a creative endeavor just to sort of take a walk. So.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I find that, that getting up and moving is one of the most productive things that I do, running or exercise as well. To go back to your point about psychedelics, I have yet to hear a single thing ever articulated to me that someone gained from psychedelics that isn't in basically every philosophy book ever written, or in some at some levels, just like basic, you know, like common sense, or you know, healthy, well-adjusted personness. But yeah, I mean, I feel like
we come optimized already. I mean, we come optimized already, even you know, I would say we don't need psychedelics, right? You don't need these substances. I would say, you know, even coffee, which, you know, I like, I drink in the morning, but with the right amount of, you know, excitement for your day or for what you're doing, you wouldn't really need these things. Like the environment would provide stimulation, right? And, you know, the environment to me is what, you know, living with green space, walking, you know, a lot of the stuff is also hard to do, which is like not have a bad boss, right? Which could ruin your life.
Sure.
You know, so there's like some stuff in your control and not, and maybe you have to change your environment too, to get to that. But yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, ceiling height I wrote about, which ceiling height went down after we introduced air conditioning into the United States because they wanted sort of a smaller space to conserve energy. But, you know, classically ceiling height has always been 11, 12 feet and has always been important. And you realize, yeah, I think better when the ceiling's a little high, when I can feel the space above my head more than I actually feel the space around me horizontally in a way. So, I mean, there's subtle things you can do as well. So.
Yeah. So you go on the walk. What other things do you try to do in the course of your day?
Always try to exercise. I mean, I don't think, I think that we're made to exercise. That doesn't mean like bodybuilding or something like, some sort of reductionist, you know, exercises, you know, full body workout, either a run, a sport, or if I'm doing a lift, do something that involves the whole body. Not a whole lot, but something to keep active. Relationships, friendships are really important. They're kind of rare these days. So if you have friends, you know, hanging out with them, you know, is like I said, I think they didn't have therapists back then, but I think they just had friends they would talk to. So, I think that's a big part of my day as well. And personally right now, I don't have a schedule and I don't have a boss. So my quality of life has really, really, increased since leaving that kind of job domain. Like, do you remember having a job? Like, do you remember like that, I mean, that world?
Yeah.
You've been out of it for a while.
I basically haven't had a salary since 2015, maybe. So it's starting to fade from memory what the idea of like having to answer to another person would look like. And yeah, you realize it's very not natural.
Right. Like I actually noticed the first album of many big artists have a song about what it feels to work for a living. Like Eminem, Kanye West,
yeah.
AC/DC, I think Boston. It goes across genres. There's always a song about working for a living. And then after that first album, you never hear about them talk about it ever again.
I always love like first rap albums that are talking about like money and bling and cars. And it's like,
right.
These are just what you imagine these things are like, because you're recording this before you had a deal. What are you talking about flying private? You've never even been in first class. What are you talking about? But I think that's a good point. It's something that artists, I think, mess up, right? Which is, there's a reason that a lot of trained writers, like people who went to like Iowa's writer workshop or whatever, all their books, the main character of their novel is like a writer who lives in New York City, who's miserable at home, right? Like they never actually capture anything that real human beings are going through, because they don't live a life that's anything close to what the vast majority of the prospective audience is like. And so I think that's a weird thing where as a creator, you have to make sure that you are living a life that tethers you to reality so that your work can remain tethered to reality as people consume it over time. Like, I think one of the reasons Seinfeld endures, for instance, is like it's friends living in New York City, hating their jobs. You know, like the shows that tap into some common part of the human experience, again, have a more Lindy aspect than something that's rooted in, I don't know, something that's not rooted in that.
You know, it's also a stressor too, as long as, and stressors are good for the most part. You know, there's good stressors and there's bad stressors. Sometimes having a day job, but that isn't super onerous. Give, you know, it's a filter. Like, I can't spend my time with, you know, on some academic theoretical thing that doesn't apply to anybody. I kind of have to, I have only a few hours left in the day. I have common concerns. So I kind of have to hone in my writing. And you see that in history. You see Kafka, you see Spinoza, you see like this long tradition of Catholic priest scientists in the Middle Ages who had a job, like they're a priest, but then they had time to research and write on the side. And the job itself can act as a filter in a way that keeps you grounded. So,
no, that's right. I think the reason my works of philosophy have reached, you know, millions more people than most professional philosophers is that when I sat down to write The Obstacle is the Way and The Daily Stoic, my premise was 99% of people not only are not interested in philosophy, they don't believe that philosophy can do anything for them. So I'm going to write these books from the perspective of being a solution to their problems, as opposed to an interesting academic exploration of an intellectual idea, right? Like, and we were talking about philosophy earlier, like philosophy as, you know, theoretical, abstract, interesting concepts, that's actually a relatively new invention. For 2000 years or, you know, 1500 years, philosophy was self-help. Philosophy was moral science, to use your term earlier. And that's why it was much more popular in the ancient world than it is today. Nobody can pronounce the names that most people think about when they think about philosophy these days. And most Harvard professors aren't doing anything in philosophy that's accessible or usable by your average person. So no wonder it's not relevant.
Yeah, I mean, I think the media environment exposed a lot of academics, right? We kind of expected them to be this really eloquent, erudite, studying the subject matter. All of a sudden, Twitter comes along and all these platforms. Okay, it's an open system now, right? Everything's flat. Let's see your talent. And it's really, some of the worst content is by, you know, people who study this for a living. And then you have people like you, right, who do this while living or integrated into life. And it's just more, meaningful, and people attract to it. And it's, yeah, you're seeing the value of sort of someone who's living in the world trying to apply this versus someone who spends all their time, right, studying it, learning it, writing about it. And it's complete, and it just doesn't make an impact. And it's in this weird bubble that I don't know. Nobody wants to go into, or it's not attractive.
And that's the last thing I thought we'd talk about, because I know you have a Substack newsletter. Sometimes people they go, oh, you're making money from philosophy. And I go, you know, college professors are paid too. They're just subsidized by the government and subsidized by, you know, unforgivable loans.
Loans and bankrupts. Like, this is crazier than Bezos or any Gates or whatever evil capitalist you want to paint. Like, you know, they're getting paid off of literally slavery.
Yeah, no, it's like the my books cost $15. It costs, you know, $15,000 a quarter to go to this private university that the philosophers are, you know, teaching at. But what I think is interesting is the idea of like, okay, this is an interesting person who has interesting ideas, in your case, selling those ideas directly to people, which is for hundreds of years how philosophy, you know, it was paid directly to the philosopher who taught classes or wrote essays or gave speeches. It was a transactional business, but not in a gross sense, but it was just like, it was a one-to-one connection often. And it strikes me that that's what I'm doing, but also what you're doing with your Substack, if you want to sort of talk to people about what you do and why you like that medium.
Yeah, it's a great medium. I really it's weekly. It's two posts a week. We cover, you know, all ideas of modernity. We mix it up with, some ancient texts. I have a podcast where I interview people as well. Sometimes they are academics, but mostly practitioners or scientists. Everything from science to philosophy to, you know, just living in a new age with novelty all around us and exploring, refinement, exploring Lindy, and also exploring what living, life working for a living too, which I think, being consistent every day isn't easy. So I like it. I like the newsletter. It's not a book. But it's not a tweet either, which is kind of disposable. There's a little bit of rigorous research and analysis that's required of it. But I like it. It's fun. I think if people want to learn more about the Lindy Effect or my writings, you can sign up at paulscalis.substack.com.
And are you going to do a book?
Yeah. I'm doing a book. I don't know what happened to you after they did an article on you, but I got an agent calling me up, and so we're starting on one right now. So yeah.
Yeah, congratulations. No, I'd already done my books when the profile came, but I know that process very well. I wish you all the best. Don't let the bastards grind you down. And remember, as we were saying, their focus is always on the newest titles, but the best books are the ones that transcend the moment they come out and offer something that lasts. I always shoot to try to make something that could be placed on the nonfiction classics table at the front of a bookstore, not something that just came out. So that's why people care about it.
I mean, you're still here, right? We're still here talking. So
I hope
you're doing something right.
Yeah, I hope when your book comes out, we can do this again.
Great, great. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for listening. We just crossed more than 50 million downloads with the Daily Stoic podcast. Thanks to you. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Please share it with your friends. Send an episode you liked. If you liked today's episode, send it to someone you know. We're always trying to reach more people, and we appreciate it. Thank you for helping us keep the lights on here at Daily Stoic. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.